So, good morning and welcome to the third part of the Lightning Talks. I'm not sure whether everyone is here who wants to present anything, but I hope so. We will do the schedule the same in the same manner as the day 2 days before. All the presentations have 5 minutes to speak. I will tell them after 4 minutes that their time will go will end, and then the next speaker is coming to present his speech. We will start with Lukas EDE, or someone not mentioned on the webpage, talking about Wollmilch, an Abba Jabba client. Is one of the three persons here and want to present? That's a good start. So we will just switch to the next one, with this, the NetBSD status report, which should have been done by Hubert Feier, but unfortunately he is ill. So his friend Stefan Schumacher will take the talk.
So hello, I didn't prepare anything for that presentation, so I'm do this out of the cuff. And first I want to mention the NetBSD project has a booth down in the Hack Center, so if you're interested in getting in contact with us, come down, drop by and ask us, and you can get CDs, DVDs and other things there. And I hope we can also answer all your questions. So now I want to introduce NetBSD to you. NetBSD 2.0 was released 3 weeks ago. And NetBSD is an operating system. It is derived from old Berkeley software distribution code. It is therefore something, it is a real true Unix. And it offers support for 55 different hardware platforms with at all 17 CPU architectures, different CPU architectures that are supported. It offers a lot of portability, and therefore you can cross-compile the kernel and userland by the standard toolchain of the NetBSD architecture, and so you can, for example, use it for development on small devices like PDAs or handheld PCs or older computers which can be compiled on a newer and more faster or more powerful machine. The complete source, the history of the source and all other stuff is available via anonymous CVS and other methods like CVSWeb or rsync. So access to all the whole source code that has been published by the project, even that has been published back in 1994. NetBSD offers also binary compatibility for most Linux, Solaris, Go, FreeBSD, OpenBSD, and other Unix programs, so it is possible to run Linux programs on NetBSD. For example, one can use Opera or Acrobat PDF Reader on NetBSD running the Linux binaries, and the emulation layer of NetBSD will make it possible to use it programs. NetBSD also supports a lot of network technologies. BSD in general is famous for its network support and its network abilities. So if you're interested in building an infrastructure for network, you can also use NetBSD, of course. NetBSD is NetBSD also has a framework for installing third-party packages. It is called Package Source. Package Source itself is also portable. You can use Package Source, for example, on Solaris, Linux, the other BSDs and other Unix machines like... Oh, forget it, other Unix machines. Package Source is a framework. You have a collection of makefiles there for each third-party package, and all you have to do is to check out these package source via CVS or FTP, copy it to your hard drive, and then you can simply enter the directory of a project. For example, if you want to install KDE or Gnome, you just have to go to the KDE directory, and you have to enter make install, make clean, and all dependencies... are built, all sources are fetched which are needed, and the whole project is built at once by the package source framework, and you don't have to interact with the system until your KDE is up and running. There are a lot of third-party packages available. Currently, I guess there are over 5,500 packages brought to package source, and there are, of course, a lot of other software that isn't available via package source is also compilable on NetBSD, if the source code is clean enough to be compiled on NetBSD. So that's currently all I wanted to tell you to NetBSD. So if you have further questions or are interested in installing it or any other interesting or are interested in further talks, you can drop by at the HackThunder booth, NetBSD booth, and ask us or talk to us and do whatever you want. That's all. Thanks.
Are there any questions yet to him?
Is it possible to run VMware or something like that on NetBSD?
Yes, I guess. I know of people that are running VMware on NetBSD, and there's also another thing called Xen coming up with 2.0. It is another kind of virtual machine, but I'm not much into the technique that is used there, but it is also offers some mechanisms like VMware.
Yes, I ask because the Linux compatibility thing, and I looked for documentation about this VMware stuff, but I didn't find anything useful, so I asked this. But it's possible, VMware
yeah,
4.
It is possible to use it.
Okay, thank
you. Okay, thank you for your talk. Next speaker is Mihi, talking about Mesh Disk, a single floppy Linux distribution for mainnet.
Just waiting for my slides to come up. Here they are. Hello, everyone. My name is Michael Bauer, or Mihi. I'm a member of the Alpha Kreis Vienna and member of the Funkfire project, which is the free network project in Vienna. And I want to present a little project of mine. It's MeshDisk. It's a single floppy Linux distribution for building up mobile ad hoc networks. Mobile ad hoc networks are widely spread today, and they even spread more and more every day. And setting up a mobile ad hoc networks is still quite a hassle. So you always have to get the right software and the right versions of the software, etc., and the right config of the software, as you have seen if you have tried OLSR here. And I started MeshDisk to make mobile ad hoc network set up fast and easy. The status of MeshDisk is still in alpha state. I've got a public CVS available, so you can check out CVS and look what's going on. And there is a preliminary disk image available. It's version 0.0.1, and it's really unstable. And there are lots of changes now, but there is no new version at the moment. So I'm quite working on it. What are features of MeshDisk? It features the BusyBox environment with Dropbear, SSHD, the PCMCI ACS, of course, the wireless tools, and at the moment, as mainnet protocol implementation, it features OLSRD. What are the goals of this project? I want to create a nice build environment for MeshDisk and for other similar projects, like, for example, embedded hardware, like the Circus, or even more into things like the Linksys, OpenWRT. I want for MeshDisk to have a human-readable central configuration, so you can do all the configuration in one file, and that's quite good readable. And quite good writable because it's on the floppy disk. I want to get into beta state and produce some stable versions, of course. And one goal is to integrate Pacman. Pacman is passive ad hoc auto configuration for mobile ad hoc networks, so that nodes that join the mobile ad hoc network get their IP automatically. There is such a project at the moment, but it's quite a hack. You can get more infos on these pages. The first one is the Mesh Disk project page at Berlioz.de. The second one is OLSR.org, the homepage of the OLSR implementation I'm using, and I think it's the most common used today. Then Freifunk.net. The Freifunk guys are up here, up the stairs. That's the Freifunk area. If you have any question about free networks and mobile ad hoc networks, just drop in there. And the last one is Funkfire.at. It's our little free network project in Vienna. And that's all at the moment. I thank you.
Are there any questions?
Well, this one obvious question, why a floppy and not a CD like everyone else does nowadays?
I didn't get that acoustically.
Why are you making a floppy Linux instead of a mini CD Linux, like Knoppix and all the stuff like that?
It is my goal was to make a floppy Linux distribution because at first it is a challenge. It is a challenge to get all these tools on one single floppy. That's one part. The other part is when you build up wireless network nodes, you want to have as less movable parts as possible. And the one thing that can be done in floppy really good is just to load everything into RAM disks, and then just never touch the floppy again. So that's a quite good thing. It can be done by CDs, but most CD distributions, as we know them, just use the CD as a root file system. And so this always involves accessing the CD again and again and again. And so you have more movable parts in there, more parts moving, and more parts that can fail.
Well, nowadays, every CD distribution has an option, as a boot option, that can copy everything to RAM, and you would just have to enable it by default. And, you know, there are more computers without floppy than without CD nowadays.
I know, and this is why I had no chance to develop Mesh Disk further at the Congress, because I just couldn't manage to get a computer with a floppy. But in most mobile ad hoc network environments, you use quite old machines for node setups, for static node setups. And so I think this is a quite practical solution in this one. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your speech.
Microphone, please.
Sorry, I have to stop because next week.
The hardware requirements is quite low, so it's designed to run on 386 computers with at least 16 megs of RAM. If you get more, it's better, because things like OLSRD are quite memory consuming if the routing tables grow. So I suggest at least 32 megs of RAM to have quite a stable node.
Okay. Next speaker is though. Talking about IT security magazines in Europe.
Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to my short talk about IT security magazines in Europe. My name is Thorsten. I'm currently a graduate student at the Laboratory for Dependable Distributed Systems at RWTH Aachen University. Originally, this talk should be was planned as an announcement of a new security magazine for Germany, but unfortunately, there were some problems, and so I have to give an overview today for security magazines, and at the end, there's a very small announcement. Let's see. Okay, of course, you know, the Datenschleuder, probably everyone here in this room has read it. It's the official magazine of the CCC. It should be published 4 times per year. The schedule is not that regular, so I think this year there were 4 issues, but that's not normal. The Datenschleuder normally deals with, on the one hand, hacking kind of topics, For example, the current issue has some the Sega bike or other. There were articles about cross-site scripting, SQL injection, buffer overflows, and all this kind of stuff. And on the other hand, there's also this culture kind of thing for hacker culture. So what events were there and this kind of articles. Then there's the Hacking 9. It's made by a company in Poland. They publish it bi-monthly. It deals with more or less IT security only, so no culture, no freedom of information, and this kind of articles. It's available in many different languages. It's in Polish, and also there's a German version, Spanish, French, and at the beginning of next year, there will also be an English version. You can also buy it in many countries, in most European countries, at the train stations or similar things that you can buy it. You get it also that they deliver it to your home. You can also buy it in some foreign U.S. countries, for example, in Mexico, Canada, and Morocco. Well, Morocco is not in America. Okay. The volume is about 15,000 issues for Germany, and there are about 30,000 issues in the other countries. The main drawback for Hacking 9, in my opinion, is that the articles in German are not that good. If you translate Buffer Overflow or Stack Overflow to German, then it sounds not good and nobody knows what you're talking about. And this is not that nice. So Hacking 9 is a nice magazine itself, but the translation, especially for German and also for the French version, are not that good, I think. And then there's the Hacker Journal. It's published by some people from Italy. The logo of them is a pirate who's looking very angry. The articles are nearly the same. So how to become a lead hacker within 5 minutes. The style is not good. The articles are not good. You get all the stuff that they publish in the magazine also for free on the internet. So don't buy this kind of stuff. Then there's MISC. MISC is also published every 2 months. Currently, it's only available in France. So if you don't speak French, you probably can understand it because all the technical details are in English. But you have to speak French to understand the whole articles. The editor-in-chief is Frédéric Renal. He's currently the author of LibNet. Probably you know him. He also did some other work in the area of app spoofing. And he's the editor-in-chief, and he coordinates everything. MISC itself deals only with IT security.
1 minute left.
Okay. So they have no culture articles, and due to legal issues, they only have they have no black hat kind of stuff, so you don't get to know how to exploit things, but more like anti-security. They mostly for legal issues. Each issue has also special topics. For example, one of the last was reverse engineering, which they covered at about 30 pages of all 80 pages, so you get a deep insight into a special topic in each issue. Okay, and then the announcement for today. There will be some German version of MISC. Probably I'm be the editor for the German version. Currently, we have some problems, but I hope this will be solved until January or February, and probably in March or so, there will be a German issue. If you would be interested in helping, or if you would be interested in buying it, just contact me, and we can talk about articles or any other kind of help. Okay, thanks a lot, and probably I have time for questions. So.
Any questions here? No? Okay. The next speaker is Gregor. Next speaker is Gregor talking about the Earth Healing Progress Report. Is he here? So apparently he's not here. Okay, is Thomas here calling, talking about the DES contest, Salt and Hash? No, apparently not. What about Rumpeltux talking about the stack smashing contest? Okay, just come over.
maybe a few of you already know, there was a stack smashing contest this year, and well, it was solved by a few people. Unfortunately, I don't have any paper, but could you open an URL?
Sure. Okay. I don't know whether it works, but we can try.
Okay, in this case, I go on without representation of the winners, so I have a list of the winners here. So is anyone here in this room who has solved these levels, because I wrote them an email, but I don't know their real names, I just have nicknames. Oh, great. And I'd like to give them the prize, because I got a stack of cookies here, and well, this would be the prize for the winner.
Perhaps a bit closer to the microphone, please.
So there were five levels to solve. The first one was pretty easy, so it was solved by about six people, and probably a bit more. And the further levels were somewhat harder. Level two was also solved by a few people, but then level three, only two people got it, and level four and level five was only solved by one person called Ilya. So, but unfortunately, they are not here.
Here.
You are?
Yes.
Who are you?
I'm Ilya.
So then come here and get your prize.
Good timing.
Yeah, maybe next year I'll continue this stack smashing contest with a few further levels, and maybe I'll do a workshop to the simpler levels in introducing buffer overflows to people who don't know of them yet. So that's it. I thank you. Bye.
Okay, the next talk will be about subnetting in P2P systems by David Goldberg.
Hi everyone, I'm David Goldberg, as you said, or David Goldberg in German. I'm from Sweden, but I speak German too, so afterwards you can ask me questions outside in English or German or even in Scandinavian languages if you like to. I'm going to talk about something I call subnetting in peer-to-peer systems, but I realize some people have a problem with that name, so you could call it subgrouping in peer-to-peer networks if you prefer. I'm a researcher full-time on peer-to-peer systems. I started researching in 1997, and since 4 years back I do it full-time. So this is what I do for a living right now, so to speak. First of all, what peer-to-peer systems are, because people always misunderstand what I mean with peer-to-peer systems. one thing all know is file sharing. Everyone have seen file sharing. But there's lots more to it. You can do distributed chat systems. You can actually do a distributed IRC server that has actually no servers. You can do distributed telephony systems, totally serverless, where the clients can call each other and talk on the internet, or instant messaging, or distributed internet radio and TV and so on. That is no. So what I'm researching is fully distributed systems, totally serverless. No one is boss. Everyone is equal in my networks. So, well, the reason I use subnetting is that not using subnetting to be monolithic like most systems are today is very inefficient. For instance, most people here have used IRC, I think. How many here do not know what I mean by IRC? Please, okay, good. In most monolithic peer-to-peer networks, you have a big network, and everything that goes on inside this big network. So that means that if node A wants to speak with node B, they have to route messages over the entire network, loading all the nodes in between and using their bandwidth. And that's pretty stupid, I think. So if we think of IRC, we're a node in this big mother net, I call it, and we want to join a channel or chat room, that is. So I make a chat room, and when I join that chat room, if I have the first node, I actually make a subnet, that is, I create another little peer-to-peer network underneath this mother net, and I announce this other net, this subnet on the mother net. And other nodes that want to join this channel, they simply join this subnet. So all nodes that's in this chat room are their own little peer-to-peer network. That means they are directly connected to each other, or at least some of the neighbors in this room. And any messages inside the chat room are broadcasted within this subnet and never traverses the big mother net. So only nodes involved in that chat room actually gets the load of the messages, and they want that load because they want to see the messages. So that makes it very efficient. But there are plenty of more reasons to have subnetting. This was, well, like the easy example. Another one is, for instance, internet telephoning. Say your wife is on vacation in Thailand and you're on vacation in America, and you log into two different computers on, and you don't know where the other computer are, you don't know their IP number or anything. So you install this little telephony software, and it logs into the mothernet, and you have usernames. Say, I'm David, and my wife is Vlada. So we type in our usernames and create little subnets. So my subnet is the subnet named David, and my wife's subnet is Vlada. So when I want to talk with my wife, Vlada, over the internet, my node, I type in I want to call Vlada. So my node joins the subnet Vlada, and suddenly she and I are in the same subnet and find each other and can start talking with each other. So that's kind of a weird example because that subnet is really only her node. So it's
1 minute left.
Sorry?
1 minute left.
Oh, really? But the really neat thing is future compatibility. That is, if I have a file sharing network, for instance, I have search algorithms running on this, algorithms making me able to search the network for files. However, this is an evolving science, how to search. So what I do is I create a subnet and I run the search algorithm in the subnet. That means the next version of the software, when I have a better search algorithm, can make another subnet and run another search algorithm in another subnet without disturbing the old nodes. And when I get even more in the future, I can plug in more and more search algorithms and stop supporting the old ones by nodes just joining the subnets where they have the algorithm and can support that kind of search algorithms. So it can be future compatible in that way. And that makes it very flexible.
Sorry, your time is up.
Yeah, so. Okay. I'll be available outside for questions afterwards.
Okay, next one is about block ciphers created by evolutionary algorithms. The talk is done by Klaus.
Yes, I want to talk about genetic algorithm in general a little bit. Yes, better. I want to talk about genetic algorithms. My cable is a little bit broken over here, which I don't think matters too much. But you can get that.
Okay.
You like Rosa? Ah, no. Okay, basically it's about creating functions which are encoded in a genome. And I put here up some like slides. It's a page on the internet. You can watch it and read the text also about it. And you see here, it's a genome, and it encodes an expression tree, which is below here. It doesn't matter which operators you use. They can be binary or unary operators. And the idea is just to have any function encoded in such a genome and to use it as a cipher algorithm. There are some operators, some genetic operators, which can be applied to such lists of symbols, actually. There is mutation, where you can mutate a single symbol, like here, and replace it by another one. And one has to distinguish between the terminal symbols, like a variable or a constant, and binary or unary operators, like plus or the multiplication. And there's also transposition. It's like here. A part of the genome, the part of the gene is moved upward or downward in the gene and produces a totally different expression tree in that moment. And things like crossover, this is like in nature. It's like they found it in the biology, and it can be applied in the computer science, where two genomes cross each other. We have former genome pair like this one here, and then they cross each other and exchange information, like here. And then there's replication, where the genomes are replicated without modification. And so we create a population of such expression trees encoded in these genomes. And we have a basic algorithm about that. It's here. It's a program control flow. First, we seed the individuals. That means we just put lots of symbols into a genome. They are random. And we try to keep the expressions valid so that they can be evaluated later on, and we enqueue them into a priority queue, first of all. And this is the key to the idea of the cryptographic algorithm, because we need to know which of the individuals we have fit best into the population we have, because we have to filter out the not so good fitting individuals, and to operate and use the genetic operators on the well-fitting ones. And if we have such a priority queue where they are ordered in a good, well-fitting manner, we can extract them and create the expression tree and evaluate the fitness of those individuals. And this is done like we iterate over the function, over the expression tree, and create a pattern of numbers. And this pattern of numbers, they can be all zeros. For example, if the first element in the genome is a zero, then the individual only produces zeros. So this is not a good cryptographic algorithm.
1 minute left.
Yes, okay, thank you. We have, therefore, we use the Huffman code, which we pack the pattern which is generated. And the better, the worse it packs, the worse it compresses the code, the better is the entropy in the pattern which was produced. And we can consider this as being a good cryptographically good individual. So if we sort them by the Huffman code size, we can do the replication and mutation. Mutation and transposition again and again, over and over, and create the a population of good cryptographically strong algorithms, actually. Yeah, that's the key idea in it, that you use a Huffman code to have the fit ordering.
Sorry, your time is up.
Yeah, thank you.
Are there any questions? Apparently not. So thank you for your speech. The next speech will be held by Dre Diddy about Mute Magazine at openmute.org.
Hello, my name is Didi. I want to show you a short presentation of the Mute magazine and Open Mute. It's a...
Okay.
What? Don't breathe in it.
Okay. I tried.
So the Mute magazine is a fairly more or less old magazine. It's founded in East London, in Whitechapel, and it's still living. It's funded by the Arts Council, the British Arts Council, and it discusses more or less the relationship between art and new technologies. Genau. It comes like every half a year they have a new issue. It's about £15, €20 each issue. Yeah. So they're fairly well known in Britain, but not in the rest of Europe. So that's why I made this lightning talk, so it gets spread a bit. Yeah. Maybe more interesting for the people here is another project called Open Mute. And Open Mute is like it was founded from, or let's say. The magazine itself had its infrastructure based on the web and everything. So they thought about it, spreading it to everybody or giving it to everybody. So they tried to more or less make give all these technologies to the people who need it, to all the resources around them, for all the local East London political groups or neighborhood groups or whatever. So what you can get from Open Mute is like a free website, a CMS system. Maybe it's interesting for your own project. It's very, very easy to use it. You just have to like more or less register. If your project is more or less on the linear from, if it fits to the people, to everything else, you can have a website. The website includes like a news, wiki, gallery, and so on. And you don't have to have any technical skills to use it. So this was like, this is made for people who don't know how to use the internet, for people who still want to use this source or this communication platform. OpenMute or OM Web is based on Linux. Running Xoop, so it's open source software, and Mute Magazine or MetaMute is did a lot of work on this Xoop CMS system to make a scalable virtualization layer for cheapo hardware. There's like two packages. More or less, we're a bit like Yahoo or something like that. We're like a normal internet service provider where you can host your website. The difference between us and Yahoo, we're friendly people. That's actually my biggest issue in it, and we're like a local base for the people in East London, maybe for the for rest. Maybe you have some friends or you know people who want to host like a CMS system without knowledge, without money, whatever. This is maybe your platform. Yeah.
1 minute left.
Okay. Meanwhile, there are about 500 sites running on OpenNewt. Like it stands here, it's political groups, art projects, local neighborhood, knitting workshops, whatever. Yeah, it's more or less based for all people who are aware of political stuff or so on. Yeah. Okay, this was very fast and short. I'm not very well prepared. My English is not too good. I hope somehow you understood what I meant. If you have more questions, we can talk maybe in English afterwards. Somebody has a question now?
Okay. When will the next issue come out? The mute the next issue of the art.
The next issue actually had to be here, and I wanted to present it, but it's not finished. They're like every more or less good organized group who. Finished in time and everything. So it's a bit of pity I don't have anything with me. They wanted to send it. There's nothing here. So you can give me an email address or I give you mine afterwards. I can give you a free copy, send it to you if you're interested in it. So, genau.
Okay. Thank you for the talk. Since we are done through all the talks which were present here from the speakers, I will try to ask whether the missing people are here. Are the people from Wollmilch here? No, apparently not. What about the Earth Healing Progress Report? Nee? Nee, den ich zum Test Contest.
Ich bin vom Shop-Test Contest.
Nee, der ist
noch verschoben worden, hat man gesagt.
Ja, richtig.
Hast du schon gesagt?
Nein, noch nicht.
Okay, hey. Some of you might have seen me on Monday on the first lighting talk. I am with a project that runs the shortest C coding contest. I'll try to do this bilingual again. Also, hallo. Einige haben mich schon am Montag gesehen. Ich bin vom shortest C coding contest. Wir hatten für heute unsere Gewinnerpräsentation gescheduled. Das ist verschoben worden. Wir laden euch alle ein im Hexenraum um 14.45 Uhr. We have rescheduled the presentation of the winners to the Hexen Room on 2:45 this afternoon. This will allow us to have a full 15 minutes instead of 5 minutes to show you actually some pieces of code that are just fun to look at and interesting. So this will be hopefully have more entertainment value for you as visitors when you come and visit the presentation of the winners. Also wir haben dann volle 15 Minuten statt nur 5, das heißt, wir können auch ein bisschen was an Code zeigen. Wir haben einige sehr, sehr nette Sachen bekommen. Wir haben ein paar Dutzend Einsendungen bekommen, sehr nette Einsendungen, und wir werden auch tatsächlich ein paar Zeilen Code zeigen, dass ihr auch ein bisschen was zu sehen habt und ein bisschen was davon habt, dass ihr zu der Präsentation der Gewinner kommt. Also, ihr seid herzlich eingeladen, 14:45 Uhr, Hexenraum, 2:45 this afternoon in the Hexen Room. Hope to see you there. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Since there's no speaker left, apparently, I will close the lighting talks for today and for the Congress. Yeah. Sven wants to talk about text tools, I hope.
All right, just 5 minutes on Mutt. Who's using a made of Mutt here? Some people do. Okay, so you know about Mutt. The Mailer Mutt's motto is all mailers suck, but Mutt sucks less. So that was all fine and dandy for about 8 years now. Mutt has recently won another award at the Linux Expo. That's fine, but it was close. I'd like to still support MUT in a way, and let it stay that way, that it still sucks least. But I'm very unhappy about its state as it is now. In the very beginning of the coding, we had one feature every day, let's say. And development was really, really fast. And I'm afraid to say that it has crawled to a halt. There are many patches about on the web when you look at it. They are linked by the MUT wiki. But their state is, well, it's lacking documentation. There's code cleanup required and many much things. Even Debian has acquired about a dozen patches that it puts into its package. But the more people are packaging different kinds of MUT, the more different kinds we get. And what is really required is to put it all together and not just wait for bugs to be finished. There is a need to put together a lot of good patches that are already about. And I would like to ask you all to help in fixing the bugs and provide more documentation. As it stands now, a lot is available, but it needs to be packaged. As I'm very unhappy about this, we've come up with a few ideas. A year ago, I was assembling all these patches and trying to do it myself when I finally realized, no, it's not a good idea. We are just creating a big, mega, super patch and give it to the maintainer, and the maintainer will just as well tell us, sorry, I don't have time, either for all the little patches or your big mega patch. That's when we stopped. So what can be done? I hope you get back into the community on the mailing list, on Comp Mail MUT news group, and, you know, put a little pressure in it by providing good information, examples, code. I hope it works out. I'm not quite sure about this will happen, but the next idea was, let's get together in a think tank at the Unperfect House in Essen, maybe for a week. Let's think about what we can do and still package it. And then later on, let's catch the maintainer at the Linux Tag in June. Thank you for listening. Are there any questions? I think it's still Thomas Rössler from the GUUK, from the German user Unix group.
Then you're out of luck. He's in Luxembourg.
He's in Luxembourg. So that's why. He's hiding, but we get him.
Not really, just working.
Huh?
Just working.
Just working, okay. So anyone? Mike, please. Any more questions? Ideas?
Apparently,
feedback, please.
Apparently not, since we have some time. Next speaker, come up.
Okay, thank you for listening. Bye.
I'm Christian Jacken, and I want to talk briefly about liquid democracy and also about electronic voting machines in Brazil. I have lived for many years in Brazil, and this is how I became involved with electronic voting. And it was extremely frustrating to see how, on the one side, the technology friendliness of Brazilians, of the population, was used to impose on them, by a central managed way, on a federal level, impose on them voting technology, which cannot even be tested by the technical personnel of political parties. and the society as a whole cannot send anyone to see if things are being made in a correct way. And so more than in the US, it is a huge threat. And interesting is to know that electronic voting started much earlier in Brazil than in the US, or perhaps not necessarily historically, but when the Brazilian election of the presidential election of 2002 already was conducted with almost 100% of electronic voting machines. And currently, although the software is said to be mostly Brazilian, major suppliers are Microsoft with Windows CE and Diebold. But it is advertised as mainly being Brazilian technology. And in fact, the system running on it, beside the operating system, was developed mainly in Brazil. But if it's not open, if it cannot be verified, then it's not an acceptable solution. Well, so to make the bridge to liquid democracy, probably some of you were at the Emergent Democracy speech of yesterday. And liquid democracy is about more participatory democracy. It's about finding tools to letting many people participate without it becoming a mess, without democracy becoming a mess. And so it also has to do, of course, with electronic voting technology. So when we eventually come to a point where we have algorithms or code which enables us to do certain things online with a reasonable degree of safety, we can think of many interesting enhancements to democracy, like that deputies or congressmen don't have to be elected for fixed terms. It can happen dynamically. People can choose at any time who they trust.
1 minute left. And,
thank you. And so, for example, if you choose to trust to pass a certain voting power to someone and you trust, then that person could pass on this voting power to someone else that person trusts. So whole new ways of leadership can emerge by this, and will be very interesting to see what impacts it produces. Also, on a very small level, for example, in NGOs, in Vereine, in associations, all kinds of organizations. And our provisional website is www.conevo.org. That stands for Conscious Evolution. So CONEVO.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions? If not, I'm closed.
Well, it's more like a comment. Many years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, before I became a peer-to-peer researcher, I actually worked in the EU e-voting project, working with electronic voting systems. And we who worked there actually more or less proved that electronic voting can never be made safe. All systems anyone could think up was hackable. So the existing paper systems we use in Europe today are much, much more safer than any e-voting system we could come up with or anyone else have come up with. So many of us who worked with it left the project because we thought it was silly, because e-voting is dangerous. That's what we think. So I would like to say to everyone, if the government tries to force you to e-vote in the government election, don't e-vote. Use paper. It's safer.
Yeah. Definitely, we don't want anyone to be forced to use electronic voting methods. And paper voting should always be preserved as at least as a backup. We admit voting machines, but if there is a paper audit trail. And but there are interesting ideas about how to use, for example, RSA on electronic voting by distributing the keys in a way that votes can be, or decisions can be made publicly accessible, for example, on the Usenet, that there would be tools providing that anyone could check the validity of the postings while preserving the privacy, of course, if the person posting them is using an anonymized gateway in order to post them online. So that is something we are also working on in our software implementation of Liquid Democracy, which again you can find at conivo.org. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your spontaneous talk. And with this, I will close the Lightning Talks for today and for the rest of the Congress. Thank you for listening and have a good day.